Chaimin Lachie Elie the Donald Mackenzie don't do 15 crossbuster a shega in Gachi who Ayrinish who operation any the Hulen. Agus Bashin Manasavish to plead in also now the Cardus. Agus Ganich me a Donald Gorado de Gendulich nach the Kaladiv screaming my crossbuster. Now here Nurpna Gad is the return Rodigan screaming a hatch lush. Agus sans mwynhau mi yn hwgw a eintyn. Nen yna ni'n hyn sa hyn yr rwydig yn hwyd e pechwad. Fa misio ma'n fa ffisig fa mi ydd ma'r haedd môr an research yn ôl yn garden. Agus môr an he rhaid mi gwnt i sy'n. Agus mwysrwn ha mi gwysio eti. Mwla rwydig yn dwlych dy gwnl gyfyd. I am reserving full copyright of all the things that's on this tape, and if it falls into the hands of anyone, an authorized person, I would like them to refrain from using it, because our intention at the present time is to publish. There is, of course, difficulty in funding for publishing, but we'll get the work done and then we'll see. I am putting this on tape for the benefit of Donald Mackenzie Crossbus. It's not so easy for him to read now with his eyes, and he's not able at all to write. And I just want to inform him. Now, in the first place, I want to state the format of the work as it occurs to me at the moment, anyhow. Now, we start by a small chapter with the attempted clearance of Limerick in 1842. Then I put down a chapter with the people that was actually in Limerick and cleared, a sort of social document of the families and the age of each member of the family, and the number of families that was there. That's chapter 2. Chapter 3 will be the same thing for Orrancy, all the families and their ages. Chapter 4 will be the actual clearance, giving the history of that year from June 42 to June 43, and the people were cleared. And most of the people of Limerick and Orrancy went to Crossbus, not all of them, but most of them. I have detailed the various places they went to, and we'll come across that later on. then the establishment of Crosspost. Crosspost was established by the people that came from Limerick and Orrancy. And then the whole genealogy of Crosspost up to the present day. And something about the church, because the disruption was in the same year as the establishment of Crosspost, 1843, which is 150 years ago. Then a short piece on the post office, which was a big feature in Crosspost at the time. And then we go on to a return of the people of Crosspost to Orrancy, where they came from, in the land raiding of 1891. And some of them found themselves imprisoned in Inverness. We'll have to try and get something on the fishing. I haven't been able to get anything on the fishing yet, but there has been boats in Crosspost, and we'll have to get something on the fishing. And and various other things, stories and songs, if there's any in traditions. I certainly have to look for photographs. And most of that work is ready. The chapters on genealogy is ready for the typist. And the other four main chapters of the attempted clearance, the clearance itself, and the 1891 land reading, they're all ready, it's three chapters. And all I have to do now is search for photographs and write something about the posters in the church. Unfortunately, Alan's unfortunately, Dontus sight has not yet improved to the point where you can read or write very much. So the object of this exercise is to put on tape something. I told him I would put it on tape. It's easier for him to get a grasp of it. I am doing all the work in the circumstances and going to with my consultant. So I start with chapter 1, the attempted clearance of the Loch Shell crofters in 1842. The crofting township of Crosspurs is situated on the northern shore of Loch Erithun in the parish of Loch, some 6 miles south of Stornoway by sea. The township was established in 1843 by crofters who were seeking refuge from the clearance of Limerick and Hornsey on the northern shores of Loch Shell, some 15 miles further south. The history of the township and its people is therefore unavoidably linked with the cruel saga of the clearances of Limerick and Hornsey in 1843. The word Crosspost is of Scandinavian origin and means farmstead. The Lewis estate was advertised for sale in 1842, and there was also a change in the tenancy of the Park sheep farm that year, when the long oppressive reign of the Stuart brothers, Alexander and Archibald, was coming to an end, and with the expiry of that lease of the farm lands and the incoming tenant, with the expiry of that lease of the farmlands, the incoming tenant was Mr. Walter Scott of Hoyt. The change in the tenancy of the sheep farm provided the Lewis estate with an opportunity to enlarge the farm once again by carrying out what Highland landlords euphemistically referred to as a rural improvement scheme, a rural improvement scheme. On this occasion, the rural improvement scheme involved the clearance of the entire crofter population of Limerick and Hornsey, usually referred to as the Loch Shell crofters. The drama of the ejection of the crofters is reported briefly in the Inverness Courier of 15th June 1842 under the heading Deforcement of the Law as follows. And I quote, "Another of these painful scenes which lately have been too prevalent took place on 2nd June 1842 at Loch Shell in the parish of Loch in the county of Ross." See, for Mackenzie, like his compatriots in the Highlands, felt that commercial sheep farming was a more profitable land use of his Lewis estate than crofter tenants, particularly seeing the profitable kelp industry had declined and the crofters were regarded as surplus labour. Therefore, the estate felt quite justified to remove the crofters and replace them with sheep, which was very profitable towards the end of the 18th century and the early part of the 19th centuries, because of the keen demand for mutton and wool the expanding towns and cities of the South because of the Industrial Revolution. The first commercial sheep farm in Lewes was established at Ballymus, in the southern tip of the Back Peninsula, in the opening years of the 19th century. As the whole Park Peninsula was occupied by crofters at that time, several small townships were cleared in order to establish the sheep farm. To begin with, the Park Sheep Farm was tenanted by a group of Skye men, and their manager was a Mr. Donald Stewart, who came originally from Perthshire to be a shepherd in Park. Eventually, he became the tenant of the Park Sheep Farm before moving to Luskentyre in Harris as a sheep farmer and later on as an estate factor in Harris. Donald Stewart was succeeded in the tenancy of the Park Sheep Farm by his two notorious brothers, Alexandran and Archibald, locally known as Gilliamhorn of Paddock, or the Wild Stewards of Park, Stewart Brothers of Park. They treated the local population cruelly, as did their brother Donald in Harris. It was said that these Stewards were descendants of Ulstermore, the Wolf of Badenoch. It was during the long tenancy of the Stewart brothers, which extended over a period of nearly 30 years, that the Park Sheep Farm expanded steadily until the Cheviot Sheep had replaced hundreds of crofters living in over 30 small townships in Southern Park. As the map in the front of the book shows. Eventually, the Park Sheep Farm covered nearly two-thirds of the land surface of the peninsula, or 42,000 acres, leaving the remaining crofters crowded on to the 26,000 acres of land in the northern part of the peninsula. The crofters that were forcibly evicted from Park settled in villages all over Lewes, such as all the townships in northern and southern Lough, as well as Barras Point, Airtongue, Back, Tolstoy, Roundabout, Stornoway, etc. It was against that background that the estate planned the despicable act of forcibly evicting the two law-abiding crofter communities of Lemuel and Ornsey, under the pretense of a rural improvement scheme. These communities were highly integrated communities, living about 1 mile apart, and at that time they consisted of about 60 families of over 320 souls. Their annual rent was fully paid up, and in fact, they offered to pay the whole of their annual rent in one payment each year in return for a lease of their lands, but the estate refused to accept that offer. The estate opened the altercation with the usual preliminary coupled up allegation of sheep stealing against the crofters of Lochelle, without giving them the opportunity to clear their names in a court of law. That form of character assassination enraged the people of Lochshell and made them more determined than ever not to leave their homes, as they said, with ruined characters, as they put it. They asserted that there was never a single act of theft proven against them. The next move on the part of the law of the Lewes estate was to seek a warrant from the sheriff to evict the crofters. The petition for the warrant for eviction was signed by the new legal agent for the Lewis estate, a man known as Donald Munro, who had just arrived in Lewis in 1841 as procurator fiscal. Mr. Munro, the tyrant known locally as the Shaw, was therefore participating in his first of many Crofter evictions, until finally he became involved in the famous Berner riot of 1857, which proved to be his downfall. In March of 1842, the Sheriff of Rosshire granted discreet of removal against the Crofters of Rochelle, an extract of which reads as follows. I quote, "Hereby grant warrant to officers of court and their assistants, similarly to eject Kenneth Mackenzie, John McLennan, Angus McInnes, Duncan MacMillan, and all the tenants of the two townships, and their respective wives, bairns, families, servants, subtenants, quarters, dependents, and cattle, goods and gear, forth and from their homes and gardens, etc." End of quotation. Once Mr. Munro was armed with the necessary warrants of ejection, he changed his hat, and as procurator fiscal, he joined a posse of strong-armed vandals who proceeded to Rochelle, probably by sea, because there were no roads in the district at that time. The party was headed by the sheriff, and consisted of the factor, the procurator fiscal, ground officer, garagent, constables, and others. The indications from local tradition, Bill Addish, is that the crofting community of Rochelle expected the evicting party and formed a plan of peaceful resistance to defend themselves and their homes. On reaching Rochelle, the sheriff and his party were confronted by a determined community who showed no signs of intimidation. There were three particular points they raised. They demanded that the false allegations of sheep stealing levelled against them be withdrawn before they would consider leaving their home. They also pointed out that the estate had not made any alternative provision for new landholdings or houses for the 50 or 60 families they were arbitrarily evicting from their homes. Also, their crops were in the ground and growing at that time, in June, and their annual supply of peats were recently cut and drying. If, therefore, they were to leave their homes at that time, they would lose their crops and annual supply of fuel, and what was to sustain them through the coming year and keep their families warm through the winter. The prearranged plan was that the women would spearhead the community protest, while the men folk remained in reserve, looking on casually, but obviously interested in the proceedings and supportive. The idea was to avoid giving the powerful evicting party any excuse to arrest the breadwinners at the beginning of the fishing season, and thereby effectively breaking down the community resistance. The community showed solidarity without provocation. At the same time, the evicting party was heavily outnumbered, and they would not dare use violence against the women for fear of a riot in that remote area of the island. It was an act of psychological intimidation by the helpless rural community against the powerful forces of the establishment. While the argument was raging, the estate officials, Niharatin, were becoming impatient. They were not used to discussing the business of evictions with wretched Crofter. They felt they had come to Loch Shell for a specific and legitimate purpose of clearing the Crofters out of their homes in the usual way. They wanted to get on with it, with their task, and therefore, after waiting for a while, the wrecking party moved in and proceeded to demolish the Crofter houses by removing the thatch from the roofs in the usual rough way. Suddenly, there was a forward rush of women with some kind of Gaelic war cry as they concentrated on one specific person. We are not given to the identity of the victim, but we may be sure the heroines of Loch Shell selected one of the most prominent members of the party, perhaps the sheriff or the procurator fiscal. Obviously, everything was done in an orderly fashion, because reports indicate that the women took great care not to inflict any bodily injury on their victim. They gave him what was referred to as rough handling. Whatever tactics the women of Loch Shell used to defend their homes on that warm sunny afternoon on the shores of Loch Shell, they were eminently successful, because the Inverness Courier tells us that, quote, the evicting party were driven off the field. It is difficult to imagine these hardy and cruel men in full flight for the shore and the protection of their boats, followed by a rabble of women shouting some menacing threats of some kind in Gaelic. Could it be that the unanimous cry of the women was, cut his trouser braces, cut his trouser braces? At that time, the police themselves were not averse to using such tactics as slipping a man's trouser braces and dropping his trouser around his ankles and rendering him helpless if he resisted arrest in a sufficiently determined way. In our young days, it was nothing unusual to be threatened by a bantering, high-spirited group of women at a pre-wedding hen-plucking party or a walk with a ploy of curry's braces. We have never seen the threat carried out, but we considered it wiser to keep our distance in case they meant what they said. It is perhaps significant that it is recorded that the heroines of Loch Shell did not inflict any bodily injury to the victim. And it is equally significant that the other members of the evicting party did not come to the assistance of the unfortunate victim, but were driven off the field. Whatever the tactics were, the respectable dignitaries of the Stornoway evicting party retired from the scene hastily. And who wouldn't, if they had visions of themselves being immobilized and struggling to preserve their dignity and respectability, with their trousers falling round their ankles in an embarrassing scene, scores of wild, unsophisticated women laughing at them, and an army of brawny men passively standing by with a smirk on their faces and their hands in their pockets. Once the evicting party was safely back in Stornoway, the Loch Shell episode was duly reported as a serious case of defacement of the law. The establishment moved fast by seeking advice from the Lord Advocate, not of course with a view to ensuring that the Rocket Crofter community of Loch Shallow might be given justice and fair play, by setting up an independent inquiry to hear the Crofter side, but to ensure that the Crofter noses were ground into the dust for daring to defend their homes and their good name from the so-called owners of the soil, assisted by the preterized justiciary, an independent government who used the police and the military to keep the Crofter population in subjection to the landlord class. Even the church, whose conscience was stifled by the laws of patronage, often supported the claims of the landlord class that the soil of the Highlands was a private asset belonging exclusively to the privileged landlord class. In the next two chapters, we set out a social record of the two crofting communities of Limerue and Ormsey, family by family, as they were at the time of the traumatic experience of eviction and homelessness, as well as where they went to live. The following is an analysis of the population of the two townships of Limerue and Ormsey in 1843 at the time of the eviction. So here we have sent down a graph. Married couples in Limerue was 28. Children under 5 years was 32. Children from 6 to 20 years was 89. Adults from 21 to 65 years was 19. Over 65 was 2 people. Already married was 6 members of their families. A total population in Limerue of 204. And these families, after they left Limerue, got another 58 children born to the families. In Ormsey, the figures are 22 families, with 20 children under 5 years of age, and 67 children from 6 to 20. 20 adults between 21 and 65, and 5 people over 65 years of age. There were 10 of these family members already married, which gives a total population in Ormsey of 166. And after they left Loch Shallow, they got another 25 children into these families. So the total population was in the region of 370 people. Now this is chapter 2 now, and I'm not going to go too deeply into this chapter. It is a matter of family by family. The pages headed the clearance of the Crofter families from Limerick in 1843, and for the sake of identity, I call them family 1, 2, 3, etc. So if I start with family 1, who resettled at 1 Crosspost. At the time of the clearance of the Crofter from Limerick in 1843, the family of Murdoch Kennedy consisted of 3 young children between the ages of 3 and 8 years old as follows. Angus was 8, Mary was 6, and Donald was 3. And after that, they got another 3 children, Roderick, in 1844, the year before. Following year, and John in 1847 and Mudo in 1851. Now it goes on like that, and we set out all the families in each of these two villages in that fashion. so that the intention is to see at a glance the way these families were when they were being evicted from Lough Shell. And it's very interesting to see that the ages of the children. Sometimes there was quite a lot of children. In the case of Tramathoi Kian, at 7 crossbows, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 children from 2 to 14 years old. And they got another 4 afterwards. So all these were families with young children and still getting a family. And it would therefore be a very traumatic situation to be faced with being turfed out of the house, of your home, and nowhere to go. Now, I will leave that at that. I will look at the family in Ormsey now in chapter 3. And the first family in Ormsey is going to 4 crossbows. It is John Mackenzie, son of Mother Mackenzie, Catherine Macaulay, was his wife. And Isabella was born in 1841. She was under 2 years when she was evicted. And they got another 6 families thereafter. So on it goes like that, you see. A brief picture of each family as they were at that time. Now, we go on to chapter 4. Now, these chapters need to be revised, of course, not quite complete yet. So, we come to chapter 4, which is headed The Eviction of the Lough Shell Crofters in 1843. Now, that's 1 year after the attempted eviction. As soon as the Lord Advocate became aware of the deforcement of the law by the crofters of Lough Shell, he directed Sheriff Jardine to proceed to Lewes at once in order to superintend the execution of the warrants to remove the crofters of Lough Shell. The following quotation from the records in Edinburgh indicates the speed with which the Lord Advocate moved. Accordingly, his lordship arrived in Stornoway about the end of the said month of, and I quote, said month of June 1842. But the petitioners, that is the Lewes estate, were of the opinion that an attempt to remove the tenants by means of military force at that time, when the estate is on the market, might injure the same, unquote. So, you see, there it was. The estate was on the market in 1842. And the big consideration was not to injure the sale, get as much money as possible. The long reign of 234 years of the civil regime in Lewes was drawing to a close. James Stuart Mackenzie of Seaforth, who had been Member of Parliament for Ross and Cromarty, including Lewes, from 1830 to 1837, when he became governor of Ceylon, where he was until ill health forced him to retire in 1841, had died in Southampton on his way home in October 1842, in his 59th year, and the Lewes estate was put on the market. The trustees were determined that nothing must be allowed to devalue the estate in the eyes of the public at that critical time, and it was not therefore convenient to give the crofters of Lough Shell the full military treatment they deserve for their obstinacy. However, having initiated removal proceedings against the Lochshannel Crofter, the matter must be pursued, and maximum pressure applied in a subtle way behind the scenes. And who better to do that than ashore, Donald Munro? It was at this time that a new dimension came into the drama of Lochshannel. Louis McKeever, the taxman at Gress, who had an unenviable reputation for oppressing crofters, and was therefore the most unlikely person in the whole world to show sympathy to the deprived crofters of Lochshannel, actually intervened on their behalf and championed their cause with the Louis estate. At first sight, it is difficult to understand why should Louis McKeever want to become involved in the affair of the remote crofter fishermen of Lochshannel. But the explanation lies in the fact that in his other capacity as a fish curer and merchant in Stornoway, where he had another residence, he had a pecuniary interest in the fishermen of Lochshannel. He was involved financially. At that time, fish curers and merchants often extended credit and guaranteed bank loans for the purchase of boats and fishing gear for the fishermen. Sometimes boats were share-owned between a crew and a shore-based person like a fish curer. Also, it was the normal practice at that time for fishermen to enter into a binding agreement to sell their whole season's catch exclusively to one fish curer in return for a guaranteed price for the whole season. That practice continued universally until the 1880s, when the catches were first auctioned on the open market, and the prices obtained by fishermen were determined by market forces. The Sheriff Court records at Edinburgh refer to instructions given by the Louis estate trustees to their agent, Donald Munro, to enter into a written agreement with the respondent's agent, Louis McKeever, who had unfortunately mixed himself up with the crofters by his professions of fish curing and merchant. That proves beyond doubt that Mr. McKeever's interest in the Lochshannel Crofter fisherman was not entirely altruistic. It would not therefore be in his best interest if the fishing crews of Lochshannel were broken up and scattered all over the island, as was the intention of the Seaforth Louis estate at that stage. An agreement was therefore drawn up between the Louis estate, represented by Donald Munro on the one hand, and Louis McKeever representing the crofter fishermen of Lochshannel on the other. The agreement provided for an extension of 11 months for the tenants of Lochshannel, and the new date for the evacuation of Limerick was to be 1 May 1843. Mr. McKeever undertook the responsibility to guarantee that the crofters of Lochshannel would carry out their side of the bargain, and he stood surety for them in the sum of £50, as well as guaranteeing full payment of their annual rent of £70 if the crofters failed to vacate villages by the due date. On the surface, Mr. McKeever stood to lose £120, which was a considerable sum of money at that time, probably equivalent to £1,000 in payment in present day money value. In actual fact, Mr. McKeever was safe enough if he kept the crew, the crofter fishermen at Loch Shell, in business for another year. He would then deduct his expenses from the earnings at the end of the fishing season, which was about to start at that time in June, when he entered into the agreement. It is a debatable point as to whether the intervention of Lewis McKeever in the affairs of the crofters of Loch Shell was in their best interest or more favourable to the estate. In actual fact, the estate realised that Mr. McKeever was in an embarrassing position, and they used him by exploiting his position. On the other hand, he had nothing to lose if he was able to delay the departure of the tenants to the end of the current fishing season. The Loch Shell crofters were in a strong position, whether they realised it or not, and if they had been represented by a professional solicitor, he would probably have advised them to suit pretty and ignore the approaches of a dying dynasty and wait to see what would be the attitude of the new landlord. We now know that the new landlord of Lewis James Mackenzie took over in the following year, 1844, but by that time the crofters of Loch Shell had been ruthlessly evicted. Unfortunately, there were no independent solicitors in the neighbourhood, and even if there were, the crofters could not afford to retain one. Neither were the crofters at this early time organised in a representative body like the present Crofters Union, and they were therefore ticked off as small communities one at a time. The original agreement prohibited the Loch Shell tenants from sowing any crops in 1842-43, but perhaps they were aware that they had nothing to lose by employing delay tactics. In any event, they refused to sign the agreement on these terms, and there followed a prolonged period of wrangling between Donald Monroe and Lewis McKeever. The crofters stood their ground, and eventually the agreement was modified to the extent of giving the tenants an extra month till 1st of June 1843, as well as permission to sow a season's crop if they could secure it. The terms of the new agreement were that the tenants and their families, with their stock and all their personal possessions, had to leave by 1st June 1843. That they could leave one person from each family behind in order to protect and weed the growing crops. Those left behind were to be nominated by the estate factor, and they were to live in their barns, as the houses had to be destroyed not later than 1st June 1843. Provision was also made in the agreement for the return of some of the evicted tenant families in order to harvest the corn and potatoes, but only as fixed by the estate factor. The whole crop and the last of the guardians and their possessions had to be out finally by 1st November 1843. By that time the winter was setting in, and Lewis McKeever pleaded for some flexibility, pointing out that the tenants could only remove their crops, quote, when the weather would permit of them going with their small boats with top heavyweight loads. Apparently, there was no relaxation from the strict terms of the agreement, but in fact, the harsh conditions were confirmed as follows. and I quote, "Any deviation from the whole terms of the agreement would render it invalid, and Lewis McKeever and the said tenants would be conjointly liable to a fine of £50. Mr. McKeever's plea on behalf of the crofters for some flexibility in the removal of their crofts by venturing out onto the open sea in October, November with two very small boats was an eminently reasonable plea, as anyone with experience of the sea in that area knows full well. The numerous drownings of lifelong experienced fishermen in the area testifies to the real danger to any boat, far less a loaded top-heavy boat. The refusal of the estate to listen to reason shows the lack of a spark of humanity or sympathy for their less fortunate fellow human beings. Obviously, the men and women of Loch Shell were made of sterner stuff, and they were not going to allow anyone to intimidate them. They were equally determined, and they refused to sign this agreement as well. Notably, among them, Kenneth McKenzie, John McLennan, Angus McInnes, and Duncan McMillan, and others. Considerable correspondence and debate passed between Donald Munro for the estate and Lewis McKeever for the tenants. Eventually, a special messenger was sent to Loch Shell with a letter to Peter McEwan, the schoolteacher, so that he might try to get the dissenters to cooperate, but to no avail, and eventually yet another Considerable correspondence and debate passed between Donald Munro for the estate and Lewis McKeever for the tenants. Eventually a special messenger was sent to Loch Shell with a letter to Peter McEwan, the schoolteacher, so that he might try to get the dissenters to cooperate, but to no avail, and eventually yet another messenger was sent, but still the crofters refused to sign the agreement. Apparently, one of the contentious points at issue was the fact that the estate refused to provide alternative landholdings for the homeless families that were being ejected. The estate maintained that they had no obligation to provide alternative accommodation. As late as the 2nd of May 1843, less than 1 month before the final date set by the estate for the evacuation of the two townships, the Lewis estate was still asserting in a letter to Lewis McKeever that they had no responsibility for the provision of alternative accommodation for the 50 or 60 families that were turning out of their homes at Loch Shell. And the letter was as follows, and I quote, that they were not bound and that they came under no obligation to provide new lots for the tenants of Emroe and Nornsey, but in order to render the removal as easy as possible, the estate agent are furnishing the respondent, Lewis McKeever, with a list of 48 lots that were kept open for them in various parts of the island. Note, in various parts of the island. Again, this last-minute offer was not acceptable. Not acceptable to the tenants because of several good reasons. For one thing, the 48 lots on offer was not sufficient to accommodate all the families that were leaving, that were being evicted, and naturally they were determined to show solidarity. Secondly, the belated estate offer of lots in various parts of the island of Lewis meant the breakup and dispersal of what was hitherto an integrated community, now to be forcibly scattered throughout the island through no fault of their own. Thirdly, both crews would be separated and families would be separated from their relatives. Fourthly, they considered that their present location was eminently suitable for access to the rich fishing grounds offshore, as well as the sheltered bays, lochs and anchorages of Park. All that was to be lost to them if they were scattered throughout the island. Fifthly, they and their forefathers lived on their present land for generations, and they felt they had a perfect right as a local indigenous population to continue living on what they now regarded as their own land. Sixthly, their area in Park was eminently suitable for stock, and they were afraid that the estate were preparing to dump them in upon strangers in various parts of the island by subdividing crops that were already inadequate for one family. That was a common practice by the Seaforth estate, and doubtless many of the 48 crops on offer were subdivisions of inadequate small crofts whose owners were unable to pay the rent, or perhaps crofts whose tenants were being evicted because they were in rent arrears. Seventh, perhaps worst of all and harder to bear, was a breaking up of the community spirit of their well-integrated communities without any hope of ever resuming their happy life together elsewhere again. Apparently, the Loch Shell crofters were themselves engaged in a search for suitable accommodation without the knowledge of the Eloise estate, and it came to the ears of Donald Munro, and he promptly wrote to Louis McKeever on 29th May 1843, only 3 days before the crofters were due to vacate their home. His letter reads as follows, and I quote, "As I understand that either you or the tenants of Loch Shell appealed to Donald Stewart of Luskentau to give up the farm of Crossbus, leased by him from the Lewis estate to the tenants, I beg of you to inform me if my information is correct, for if it is, and it is at all practical, I am disposed to think the trustees would not be against negotiating with Mr. Stewart to take the farm off his hands immediately for the above purpose, and thereby add to the leniency, great mercy, and forbearance which have been already shown to these tenants. While any lots which the trustees may give to these tenants must be held as a voluntary act on their part, and forms no element in the agreement of June 1842 or March 1843, I write this without prejudice to the trustees' claims under the said agreements and the proceedings which they may adopt in reference in the event of the tenants not moving on 1 June 1843, all of which are hereby reserved entire." End of quotation. It is clear from the above letter that the crofters of Loch Shell would have been better off if they had declined Mr. Louis McKeever's offer to represent them and continued to refuse to sign or agree to anything. In the absence of the military, Mr. Munro had no means of removing a few hundred crofters and the fact, despite his blustering, he was very glad to find a way out of his dilemma And once he heard about Crossbus, he reacted favorably at once. He must have seen Crossbus as a way to get himself off the hook. Probably he did believe he had shown great mercy, leniency, and forbearance to the Lochshell tenants. Donald Stewart of Luskentyre, the Stewart of Moorvoor, was well known to the crofters of Lochshell. He was the tenant of the Park Sheep Farm at one time, and we may be sure they knew that he was the tenant of Crossbus, while subletting it to Kenneth Mackenzie Cuinneach Patachroe, or Cuinneach Crossbus, as some call him. They may have met Donald casually, or they may have asked Louis McKeever to write to him on their behalf. It was a sad irony that the poor, deprived crofters of Lochshell found themselves, through no fault of their own, mixed up with the three most notorious tyrants the Long Island produced in its long history, Donald Munro, Louis McKeever, and Donald Stewart. All these crofters wanted was to be left alone with their families to earn their living from the land and the sea, by sheer hard work. They even built their own homes without any assistance from any quarter. 4 years earlier, in 1839, Donald Stewart cleared the crofters of West Harris cruelly, without a spark of mercy. He caused their fires on their hearths to be drowned with the household milk, while the thatch was ripped off their homes with hooks, and even the roof timbers and the thatch was collected and burnt until there was nothing left but the blackened shells of their once hospitable home. He was now prepared to be magnanimous towards the crofters of Bath. He gave up his lease for the deck of Crossbus, and his sub-tenant Kenneth Mackenzie moved across Loch Erso to Cropick, where his father-in-law, John MacDonald, the Anglo-Hadoo, was a taxman. It is obvious that the crofters were not able to arrange for the vacant possession of Crossbus within the appointed time of 1st June 1843, and that is confirmed by the evidence of Donald Mackenzie, 24 Crossbus Mon Rogue, Yanni Callister, 1817 to 1895, at the Napier Commission meeting at Cowes in 1843, some 40 years after his eviction at the age of 26 years. His evidence was as follows, and I quote, "Our first complaint was to be driven from Lochshell 40 years ago, when our fire were drowned on the hearths by officers of the estate, and the people were fined £50 sterling for not leaving on the appointed day. Then the people were put into a smaller village than either of the two villages they were driven from." End of quotation. Mr. Mackenzie's evidence confirms the fact that the crofters of Lochshell had a second visit from the estate wrecking party in Hereford, who doused their fires on the hearths with water and fined them £50 for failing to leave by the appointed day. It was the people that paid the fine of £50, and not Louis McKeever, who undertook the responsibility of guaranteeing that payment. How could the people leave until Crossbus was ready to receive them? Donald Munro, the show, and his Yarragin was only concerned about the fact that the appointed day of 1st June was passed and leave they must. So the Yarragin, the state officials, descended upon them and showed no mercy. It is difficult to imagine the chaos and terror that was created by the vandals of the evicting party as they forced their way into the crofter homes with buckets of water. Women, children, old people, and possibly ill people, frightened out of their wits, as the fire on the hearth in the middle of the floor was drowned with water, raising clouds of steam, smoke, and peat ash in these dimly lit homes. One can imagine bewildered children screaming and clutching at their mother's skirts for protection from these strange intruders who invaded the privacy of their cosy homes. Is it any wonder that a lasting impression was made on people, but particularly on the young people, who might be psychologically scared for life? As for many of the adults, they were no stranger to the cruelty of the estate officials, because many of them had experienced more than one eviction as the people were gradually displaced as the sheep farm encroached on their land during the previous 40 years, until over 30 small crofting communities were removed from 42,000 acres of Sutherland Park. In 1843 clearance brought the sheep farm to the common grazing boundaries of Gravel and Harvest in the north. Local oral tradition, be a laddish, maintain that the crofters of Loch Shell were ready with a pre-arranged plan for the reception of the attempted eviction of 1842. Considering the details of that drama in 1842 and its success, it is reasonable to assume the truth of that tradition. During the following year, the crofters were subjected to tremendous pressure by the estate, and towards the end of that period it became clear that Crosspost was becoming available to them. The evacuation of about 60 families comprising of 325 souls, together with all their household effects, cattle, sheep, fishing gear and all other things about their homes, was a major exercise that required careful organisation if it was to be carried out in an orderly manner. These men of the islands had a long military tradition, and the task in front of them at this time was not unlike a military withdrawal. Here was a chance to employ their military skill in a peaceful exercise. As there were no roads in the area, and therefore there were no removal vans available, the flitting emedich would have to be carried out by sea, except for the livestock which would have to be organised, and a team would walk them overland round the head of Loch Erthod at Malalan. Basically, therefore, the plan was to use all the available boats in a shuttle service from Loch Shell to the new destinations such as Crosspost and Glen Tolstein, in order to carry all their gear and all the vulnerable members of the community to the beaches at Crosspost and Glen Tolstein, where reception camps were set up, by building large tents using old sails spread over the roof timbers from the former homes. It was customary to allow evicted families to remove the roof timbers of their homes in order to use them to roof their new dwelling houses elsewhere. There was only one house in Crosspost and none at all at Glen Tolstein. Between them, these two new townships absorbed most of the refugees from Loch Shell. flitting day was to be a long, hard day, and an early start was necessary. Having already organized the whole community into groups and assigned certain duties to each group, the first task would be to demolish the house, the dwelling houses, and carry the roof timber down to the shore at Loch Shell, ready for the boat crews to go into action. But before the houses could be demolished, everything that was inside the houses would have to be packed and removed and carried down to the shore. Some 7 or 8 teams would be hard at work simultaneously since dawn on that summer morning in June 1843 at Loch Shell. La Nuidochi, or La Inyamedi. The houses would have to be prepared for demolition, and therefore the first team would have to be Team 1, the furniture removers. This team would consist of women assisted by a group of strong men. The women would pre-pack all the light stuff within the house, within the dwelling houses, as best they could, using Hessian bags, bed sheets, fishing baskets, etc. as containers. Then the men would move in and dismantle and remove the heavy furniture, such as box beds, benches, dressers, stools and chairs, etc. Team 2, the carriers, consisting of a group of strong men, needed to carry the heavy items of furniture and all the household gear of 50 or 60 houses down to the shore for shipment to their new destination. Team 3, the dwelling house demolishers. As soon as the furniture and all other gear was removed from the dwelling houses, the demolishing team would move in and carefully remove the roof timbers and make them available to the carriers, who would carry them down to the shore or for shipment by the transport boats. I should think that it was the roof timbers that would be the first loads to the transport boats would take to Crossbus and Glen Tolsa, because that would enable the camp team to set up improvised tents at the reception camps on the shores of Crossbus and Glen Tolsa. Team 4, the the boat crews of transport crew, a party of able-bodied young men, would be assigned to man all the available boats, and we may be sure they were generously assisted by men and boats from the neighbouring townships, such neighbourly assistance was always available in times of need. Team 5, the reception camp group. Once the roof timbers were available for transporting to the new destination, the camp team would be able to set about building improvised tents with roof timbers and sails in order to receive the more vulnerable members of the community, such as the sick, old and infirm, expectant mothers and very young children. Team 6, the livestock group. Simultaneously, from an early hour in the morning, a group of men and women, men, women and children were out on the hills of Perth rounding up the livestock and organising the sheep and cattle into droves in accordance with their ultimate destination, ready for the overland trek across the moor by the head of Loch Erisod, a distance of about 30 to 60 miles. It is not difficult to imagine the noise and chaos as the livestock were being selected into droves, sheep bleating, cattle mooing, dogs barking, men and women shouting and running excitedly back and forth, while the barefooted children were were having a great time helping where they could, but blissfully unaware of the desperate worries of their parents. Team 7, the pedestrian group. The pedestrian group would consist of those that were able to walk over the moor to Gerivard, where the boats were waiting for them to ferry them across Loch Erythrin, thence on foot to their various destinations. We know this group consisted of mothers carrying young children on their backs in shawls or creels, while walking other small children in their hands. We know that 3-year-old Dauphin, 15 crossbows, Montou's grandfather, was one of those children that walked over the moor in his mother's hand. His younger brother Alistair was born in 1843 and was therefore unborn at this time, or also a very small baby. Others in this group would be senior citizens that were still able to face the long journey from Lochshell to Crossbust or Glen Tolstein. It was necessary to leave the space in the boats for the essential passenger and material. Group 8, the crop attendants. By this time, the factor would have identified and nominated the members of the community that was acceptable to the estate as crop attendants. They could remain behind in order to protect and weed the growing crops, and they were allowed to live in the barns which was left standing for that purpose. There is a distance of about 30 miles of open sea between Lochshell and Glen Tolstein, and about 12 miles to Crossbust. And June is the usual time of the year for the prevailing east or northeast winds, which sometimes blow for weeks on end, giving rise to heavy seas. Even if they got favourable weather, the task of ferrying the awkward top-heavy loads from 50 or 60 families, and even the rough timbers, would probably take days to complete. Once the boats were no longer needed for the transport of material from Lochshell, they were divided into groups. One group were those that were suitable for the herring fishing season, which had already started in May-June. All the boats that were not needed for fishing were upturned and used as temporary accommodation. It is a well-known fact that at least one family, the Carmichaels, who went to Glen Tolstein, wintered under their boat, perhaps others as well. The Exodus. When everything was ready for the overland exodus, they set out in droves, in drove after drove, in accordance with their ultimate destination. And it was necessary to put a space between each drove after the fashion of Jacob when he was returning from Paddan Aram and he was preparing to meet his brother Esau. They would leave simultaneously from each of the two townships and climb up to the high ground above the village. Once there, they would pause for a last nostalgic look at the magnificent panoramic view of the hills of Park and the Shant Isles in the distance, but more particularly at the two empty villages below them on the shore of Lochshell, where they and their families grew up and shared many happy memories. There they could see their hospitable homes, now reduced to roofless ruins, with no fire on the hearth and no smoke rising from the houses, no children playing happily and noisily among the houses of the villagers. It was a depressing sight that brought forth much weeping as the deprived homeless families turned away to face an uncertain future, to begin with, perhaps under an upturned boat, on a beach at Crossbar. The livestock drove set a course for the head of Loch Erythor, and the pedestrian goop set a course for the ferry laid on at Gerivar. At least it was fortunate that the flight of the fugitives of Loch Sherrill was not in the winter, as there were a heavy program of work in front of them as they struggled to re-establish themselves. The first priority was to build new homes for themselves, probably temporary homes to begin with. But that would be a slow process because the menfolk would be at the summer herring fishing season, which had already started before they left Loch Sherrill. They would be too late in the year to plant a crop, and in any event, they would first have to reclaim landholdings from the virgin and cultivated land. The land reclamation program would take up all the spare time for a few winters. Probably they would attempt to cut peats, as their only means to heat their homes and cook their meals, even though the peat cutting season was past before they arrived in Crossbar. Their new homes would need a lot of firing. Their building program would not be confined to the urgent task of building new houses. They would also need barns, spires, stockyards, and a protective dike from the township before the next season's crop was put down. In the fall, they would have to address themselves to the major task of gathering the harvest at Loch Sherrill and ferrying the crops, as well as everything that remained of their gear at Loch Sherrill, probably including a supply of peat. That task had to be carried out to the timetable dictated by the estate, and both themselves and everything they had to be out by 1st November 1843. The trauma of Loch Sherrill took place against the background of the economic depression coming up to the potato blight of the mid-1840s. The distress caused by the potato flight was so severe in Lewes that it was said that if it was not for the food supplies that was brought in, that was bought with the generous contributions of sympathisers in the industrial cities of the south and distributed throughout the island, it is almost certain that lives would have been lost. Although we identify the original settlers at Crossbar with the numbered crofts subsequently held by their families, it does not necessarily follow that the original families settled at the location allocated to them at the time of the official lotting of Crossbar into 57 crofts, which was about 1850. When the new landlord, Sir James Matheson, undertook the second lotting of the whole of Lewes. There was therefore a certain amount of movement of families within Crossbar in the early days, and indeed some of the early families moved out of Crossbar, probably before the township was consolidated into the original 27 crofts. The present system of numbering of crofts in the Highlands was not generally adopted until after the passing of the first Crofters Act in 1886, which gave the crofters security of tenure and a degree of permanency in one place for the first time ever. About 15 years after the township of Crossbar was established, the population was increasing so fast as to require an expansion of the village onto the common grazing to the west of the village. The first of many families to to set up whom the common grazing was Kenan Mackenzie, born in 1837, when of Letty, son of Donald Mackenzie, Donald Mackenzie, 19th Crossbuck, who married about 1870, and carved out a small holding for himself, number 28 Crossbuck. By now, the original 27 families in Crossbuck has doubled, and most of the common grazing land to the west of the village is taken up by small holdings and few. End of chapter. We now come to chapter 5, which is the genealogy of Crossbuck. And this was completed some years ago at Donald Mackenzie and myself enrolled it once again to confirm it. It basically, what it is all the families that ever lived in Crossbuck, croft by croft. It is a kind of history of each croft. If I take page one, for instance, Murdo Kennedy, born in 1807, died in 1873, son of Rothery Kennedy Lemroy. Janet MacDonald, 1887, daughter of Mother MacDonald Lemroy and 11 Crossbuck. Their family was Angus, Mary, Donald, Roderick, John, and Murdo. And we give the dates of their births, and we give their ultimate, where they ultimately settled or married. Angus married Madirua Kennedy, 17 Cremorne, and Mary married Angus Mackenzie, 18 Crossbuck, at 32 Ranish. Donald was a bachelor, worthy called Nelson, settled at 23 Crossbuck, and John settled at 1 Crossbuck. Murdo settled at 34 Crossbuck. For the Kennedy and Margaret MacLeod, the parents of Murdo Kennedy, the head of the above family, lived in Easkin before the Crofters were evicted from there in about 1833. The family moved to Lemroy then, and it was from Lemroy that the above Murdo, who was already married, came to Crossbuck. The first three members of the their family of six children were born in Lemroy. One brother and four sisters of the head of the above family settled as follows. Marion Kennedy, 1793, married Neil Carmichael, 18 Grammer. Christina, 1794, married John Macmillan, 17 Crossbuck. Margaret, 1797, married Broderick Mackenzie, 27 Crossbuck. Mary, 1801, married Neil Mackenzie, 18 Crossbuck. Hero Kennedy, 1803, settled at 17 Cremorne. Then we go on to the next tenant on Croft 1, which is Ian Kennedy, John Kennedy, married to Mary McKeever from Babel, and they have seven children. And then the next tenant is Donald Kennedy, who is a son of John Kennedy. And then we have Donald McKinnon, married to Mary Bell Kennedy. And that's the end of that croft. These are the people that are still on that croft. And we do the same with all the croft, croft by croft, right through. Right through to 53. There are 53 croft, households in Crossbuck. And as was already referred to, there is almost as many outside crossbows from a common grazing as there is in crossbows. And some of them are on fuse. Before we come to the next main chapter, which is the land raiding of 1891, may I say that the work that is still to be done, a very important work as well, is the collecting of photographs. We really must try and get some photographs to liven the thing up. A piece on the post office, I think I have all the necessary details for that. The church, well, we have most of the details for that, but we'd have to research a little bit more for that. The fishing boats, well, we'll have to go into customers, the office, see if we can find anything about the boats across. And then, if there's any songs or stories or traditions or anything worth mentioning. And at that point, the whole exercise will be ready for publication. One of the great difficulties with these things is to find somebody that will type it. Preferably to be typed onto a disc, so that one can correct any error there is. And in any case, that is how printers want work nowadays. They want it on a disc, and they transfer it from this disc business onto the printing machine. Well, we now come to the 1891 land raiding. In March 1891, a boat with 18 men sailed from Crossopost to Oranje with the intention of resettling their former township, which was at that time uninhabited. Oranje's steamerway and the Shant Isles, an area of 4,000 acres, was at that time a grazing extension of Krabik, which was a viable farm some 9 miles away on the shores of Loch Eresert. The Lewis estate created the 4,000-acre buffer zone in 1886 when they converted the Park sheep farm into a spotting deer forest. They probably wanted a neutral zone between the crofters in the north and the deer in the south of the peninsula. The tenant at Krabik at that time was Roderick Martin, a man from Ballala. Numerous landless crofters from every village in Loch were applying for new crofts in Southern Park in the years before 1886. Particularly in Steamerway and Oranje, but they were all refused, and these two former crofter townships, of which there was a big demand, were needlessly added to a viable farm many miles away, while scores of squatter families in Loch lived in barns or temporary houses on their parents' crops. Very often, there were three or even four families on the small crofts, which were inadequate for one family for which they were meant, far less the number of families. Very few crofts in Loch were confined to one family at that time. The 1880s are known to Highland history as the time of the Crofter Land War. But in truth, the land war continued long after the first Crofter Act of 1886, because that act did not take into account the desperate needs of a large segment of Highland population that were landless and therefore homeless at that time. The long-suffering landless squatters were therefore bitterly disappointed with the failure of the 1886 Act to acknowledge their deprivation and the gross overcrowding of the whole crofting community. In Lochs, the feelings of the crofter community were exacerbated by the refusal of the Lewis estate to grant any of the numerous landless quarter applications for new crofts. It was particularly exasperating for the landless families to reflect on how no less than 42,000 acres of their forefathers' land stood sterile on their very doorstep in Southern Park, while the average share of croft in by land in Lochs, if it was to be shared out equally, would be less than half an acre per person. That's the croft in by land. Just half an acre per person. Very much less in some cases. In some cases, there were so many families on a croft that the in by croft land only averaged 1/8 of an acre per person. Taking one specific example, there were 200 people in Culbust in 1900, all living on 14 crofts of 5 acres each, a total of 70 acres, or about 1/3 of an acre of in-by land per person. These were the conditions in Lochs when Lady Matheson refused to grant a single application for a new croft and proceeded in 1886 to convert the uneconomic Park sheep farm, for which she could not find a tenant, after advertising repeatedly during the previous 3 years, since the last tenant left in 1883. She wanted to convert it into a sporting deer forest as a playground for the affluent rich from the Industrial Society of the South. The insensitiveness of refusing to allow the landless quarter to occupy at least some of the former crofting townships, such as Orrancy and Steamery, was, in the eyes of the deprived families, adding insult to injury, and they staged a peaceful demonstration at once in 1887, known as the famous Park Deer Raid, which one newspaper at the time described in the following terms, and I quote, "From the picturesque and of spectacular point of view, no other episode in the land agitation approached the famous party raid. With a modern Moses, Donald MacRae, the Balala head teacher, leading forth the starving crofters and quarters of Lochs to a land, if not flowing with milk and honey, at any rate, to a forest teeming with deer." Unquote. Both the government and the estate were unmoved by the Park Deer Raid, even though the raiders were acquitted in the High Court in Edinburgh. 4 years later, in 1891, the land-hungry families of Lochs, including the 18 men who sailed from in March 1891, were reported in various national newspapers as becoming increasingly impatient with the living conditions they were forced to endure. There was therefore fresh outbreaks of discontent among the people, because they felt that there was never any hope of a change in their living conditions so long as they continued to endure their deprivation.